And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to welcome Melissa de la Cruz to the program today. Melissa is a tremendously successful and prolific writer of fiction, mostly for the young adult market, having written more than 40 novels, including the series Blue Bloods, Heart of Dread, and The Descendants, which has been made into a series of hit musicals for the Disney Channel. Today we'll be talking about the second title in her series about founding father Alexander Hamilton and Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton. It's called Love and War, and it's published by G.P. Putnam Sons Books for Young Readers. Melissa, Love and War begins just a few months after Alexander Hamilton and Eliza Schuyler have gotten married. What have those months been like for them?
I think they're a little tumultuous. When the book opens, they are separated. You know, Alex is back kind of the front line. Eliza is in the house with her mother and sisters, and it's springtime, and they're picking berries. Alexander's not quite in the front line yet. He is with her father, her brother-in-law, and they're talking about the war. And that's when we find out that he's asked for a command, that he wants to be part of the battle. And his father-in-law, you know, tells him that, you know, Eliza's going to be devastated. You know, she wants you home and safe. Alexander Hamilton says, you know, I have to do this. You know, I have to fight for my country. And it's something that he needs to do, even though he loves his wife and, you know, obviously would love to be with his family. He feels a greater impetus to prove himself and to prove that he's loyal to the country. I like to open with a little bit of a ball. So they're getting ready for a fun party. And we find out, you know, that, you know, they're doing well. They're still very much in love. But when Eliza finds out that Alex is going to go back to the front line, she's a bit miffed about this. She's a bit upset. And his goodbye, his farewell, is not quite as loving and warm as either of them would like. But then, of course, when he's in the front lines and she's at home, you know, she writes him all these letters and he writes all these letters. And, you know, you can feel the love that they have together. I wanted to show that even though he was in the battlefield, that she was not far away from danger either. And there's a really famous story of the British redcoats coming to the Schuyler mansion for a possible raid. And the girls, you know, stood up to them. And supposedly, legend has it, one of them threw an axe at the soldiers and were so formidable that the British left them alone. And we don't know if it's true or not, but I thought it was a great, you know, kind of legendary story about these women. So I wanted to include it.
So in general, in dealing with historical fiction, how much of a responsibility do you have toward the historical record?
I think you definitely have some responsibility to hew closely to the historical record. But I also think as a novelist, you have a lot of responsibility to the story as well and to create something that's entertaining and that is a novel and not just, you know, a recitation of facts. So in the first book, which takes place with their courtship and ends with their wedding, I did a lot of research and, you know, they kind of fell in love very quickly, although they met at a ball 2 years before they started courting. And then when they met again, you know, they basically got married 4 months later and it was pretty smooth sailing. But I wanted to write something with conflict. You can't have a novel without, you know, a villain, some conflict. And so I thought, what if there was a little bit of a Pride and Prejudice storyline where the Schuylers, you know, maybe didn't want her to marry Alexander Hamilton because he was penniless and, you know, from nowhere. Well, they were one of the richest, most prestigious families in New York. And that was actually why I was interested in the story, because it felt like such an American fairy tale. Her mother was Catherine Van Rensselaer, who came from the richest family in New York. And they all just intermarried, the five families of New York, the Livingstons, the Van Rensselaers, the Schuylers. They all just married each other. So why was it that she was allowed to marry this no-name Alexander Hamilton?
And her little brother's name, Rensselaer Schuyler, is just like the most old money New York name you could
have. So old money. And you know what's so interesting is I did even more research and, you know, Peggy, Mary Stephen Van Rensselaer, who's the heir to the richest fortune in New York, you know, basically the richest man in the United States probably at that time. And Stephen's sister marries the oldest boy of the Schuyler. So there's just, you know, a lot of bonding there.
The name for the manor they have, the Schuyler family, is the Pastures.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, a place is even more elite when it has a more toned-down name.
Oh, exactly. You know. It's like the barn.
We've seen in other works over the years that can be difficult to sustain a story when a couple finally gets together. So what were the challenges you had in going on after the marriage?
Yes. You know, it's interesting because I also write in the YA genre, so I wanted to keep them as young as possible. You know, so I did want to kind of concentrate it on their kind of more youthful years. And, you know, to keep a love story, you know, like you said, after the wedding, you know, what else can you say? And so I wanted to keep some kind of conflict, some kind of drama. So one of the things I did change was they don't get pregnant right away. So there's a little bit of sadness on Eliza's part. It's totally fictionalized, where she wishes she could be a mother. But, you know, I also wanted to show, you know, the conflict between, you know, Alexander's careerism. You know, he was desperate to make a name for himself, desperate to make his own fortune. And one of the things that I discovered, which was so cool and why he's such a great guy, is that he made his name as a defender of the loyalists, of the people who are loyal to the crown. Because after the revolution, after the Americans won, they were still British people, and there were still Americans who thought of themselves as subjects of Britain, and they were living there, and they needed to be folded into the country. And Alexander Hamilton defended them from people who wanted to take away their property, you know, take away their fortune. He said, no, we need to make a country out of everybody, not just the people who were the rebels who won the Americans. It has to be everybody, our neighbors who are still here, who are loyal to the crown. They deserve justice and fairness, too. And I just thought that was so fascinating.
And it would be difficult for people to find fault with him because he was the right-hand man to General Washington.
You know, he was brilliant. He was charismatic. He was very forward-looking. And when you read, you know, his ideas on government and policy, you're just, you know, really impressed by and you feel really lucky that he was one of our founding fathers, that somebody with that kind of heart and that kind of brain was thinking for our country.
And Washington valued him so much, he didn't really want him to be at the front of the battle. But Hamilton pressed his hand. How did he do that?
Yeah, he was brave, too. Well, he, you know, he really just, you know, kind of strong-armed him. And I think it was clear that if he didn't get this command, you know, he might leave his employ. And
but it was almost a bit of a dirty trick he employed.
Oh, definitely. Always. He was a slippery fellow.
So going back, do you think he was going after fame and glory in his willingness and his eagerness to be on the front lines? Or do you think he was just that patriotic? What were his motivations for getting out there in battle when he didn't necessarily have to be out there?
You know, it's probably hard to speculate, but kind of knowing from, you know, his letters and what he wrote about it, I think he was very passionate about the country, but I do think he definitely wanted some glory. He wanted some fame. I mean, he was a very ambitious person, and I think he saw, you know, a big future ahead of himself. And like I said, he wanted to prove himself as, you know, a soldier, as somebody who was very courageous. And he wanted to be part of the action. While he knew he was a good writer and he valued that in himself, he also, I think, probably felt like he wanted to show that he was that kind of man who could go in and lead, you know, a charge of soldiers, you know, down to battlefield. So maybe a little hubris, you know, a lot of pride, and then maybe a feeling of not wanting to be left behind.
How much do you think was kind of living up to the in-laws and that his father-in-law was a general and a very wealthy man, that he had to do this in order to provide for his wife in the same way?
Oh, yeah. I think that was huge. He didn't want to just be a desk-bound clerk, you know. He wanted to be, you know, to the top, definitely. He wanted to prove himself.
Now, you'd mentioned before that things weren't necessarily safe at the home front either. Can you give us a little bit more about that incident with the British marching on the pastures?
Yes. So in my book, I made it a little bit more elaborate, you know, because all we know is that the British raided them. So I had the girls in this very kind of pleasant, peaceful scene where they're, you know, getting ready for the birth of their youngest sister. You know, so mom is pregnant and everybody is just, you know, kind of in this domestic tranquility. And they're up on the hill. And one of the younger brothers sees, you know, the redcoats coming. And so they all run back to the mansion, you know, and they have nobody. You know, they've got the servants, they've got themselves, but all the men are away and there's nobody to protect them. So what are they going to do? And so they go and basically scare the men off with lies and the British come, and, you know, Eliza says, you know, my father is here and he's going to come with his men in 1 second. So I hope for you that you're not going to be here when he returns, you know. And so she just bluffs. And they actually believe her. And I thought that was really a wonderful, you know, kind of quick thinking scene to show how courageous she is, you know, and how quick-witted she is, how she can think on her feet.
Back then, with the Loyalists opposing the Patriots trying to leave the British rule, was it equally spread all throughout the colonies, or were there pockets of Loyalism all the way through?
I think there was more like pockets, and New York had been taken over by the British, you know, so the British actually held it as one of their strongholds, and they had, you know, kind of burned the place down. I mean, all of Manhattan had to be rebuilt, you know, after the war. So it was very much a British/Loyalist city.
As history has been too much over the years, more attention's been paid to men's roles in history than women's roles. So I can understand how researching Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, would be a little bit easier. What did you do in researching Eliza and her role in their lives?
Yes, it was a little harder. I found several biographies of her that were kind of smaller press books. So I found those, and then I found some books on kind of American Revolutionary women, so kind of more general books about how they lived at that time and women's role at that time. So I found several books that dealt with kind of the domestic sphere, you know, because I wanted to know what they dressed like, what their schedules were like, what they wore. And then I also was lucky enough to hire 2 American history professors who helped me, you know, kind of pinpoint all the details. So I had somebody who was more of an expert in kind of the Revolutionary War and military kind of strategy and those kind of dates, and somebody who was more of an expert in, you know, kind of the social aspect of the time.
So how do you go about advertising for those jobs?
Yeah, I luckily have a very wide circle of friends. I've hired researchers really just through my personal network, which is kind of nice.
So looking at your bibliography, over 40 novels in the past not even 20 years, you have to have some help because that's a crazy pace.
I write mostly for teens, and, you know, I have a huge number, but some of those book series, like the Ashleys, they came out twice a year, and they're much shorter books. Yeah, I have a crazy pace. I wrote one of the Ashleys books in 2 weeks, and I concentrate a lot on outlines, so I get the book kind of done in my head much earlier than maybe other writers do who, you know, maybe they call it pantsing versus plotting. I'm very much a plotter. But yeah, I mostly write books and then I hang out with my family.
Is it a little bit easier with the more recent books, with the Descendants books, and now with the Alex and Eliza stories, in that you have kind of these established characters already there that you're working with? You're not world building from new? Or
no, I actually like just working on my own characters. I prefer creating my own world. I'm interested in, you know, 19th century fiction. I was interested in Alexander Hamilton and Elizabeth Schuyler's story, but I actually find that more difficult because there is like a historical record. There are limitations, and then with the Disney universe, again, there are restrictions and limitations on what I can do. I'm not just completely free to make up things, and that's actually what I prefer.
There is a gap in the story between the Battle of Yorktown, which we won't discuss how that goes, and then when they move down to Manhattan and start their lives down there. What did you think was important to include in the national history? Because you have this very nice chapter that kind of describes the interim. How did you decide what to include there?
I think I just, you know, I don't really recall. It was a really short.
It is a while ago.
Yeah.
It is a good six, 7 pages.
You know, I wanted to move them to New York. That was what I wanted to kind of focus on. I also alluded to what happened after the war and, you know, kind of have them reconcile. You know, I think I put in George Washington's retirement and a little bit about what New York was like when they came back into it.
Because there was a couple of years between the Battle of Yorktown and the official cessation of hostilities.
Yes, definitely. So this was the part where, you know, you try to cleave to the historical record, you know, and so you had to kind of account for those years, but there was nothing really interesting happening in their personal lives in those years. I thought I would just do, you know, a little bit of a fast forward montage.
At that time, just as the British are leaving Manhattan and heading back to either Canada or the West Indies or back to the mother country, how were loyalists being treated by the ones who had supported the revolution?
Terribly. They were being treated terribly. And the Americans felt, you know, justified in that treatment because they had won. And these people had fought for the wrong side. And so, you know, it was almost like a free-for-all. And they would, you know, during the war, they would run away from their houses, you know, and leave all their stuff and their servants behind. And patriots would move into these houses and just kind of help themselves carte blanche. You know, there would be people's portraits and their, you know, silverware there. And what a strange way to live, you know, because if it had gone the other way, somebody could have done that. And somebody did do that to the Schuylers when they burned down, you know, their Saratoga mansion and ate them out of house and home when they camped at the pastures.
Hamilton had been training as an attorney and mm-hmm. practicing up in the Albany area. What was the difference in the legal landscape in Albany and New York City at the time?
You know, Albany was more, you know, definitely Schuyler land, you know, and he probably had like a lot of clients because of his family and his father-in-law. But I think he also felt like that was not the place to be, that New York was going to be the capital. And New York was kind of a lot more exciting for somebody who wanted to make his name for himself.
The law was a little bit different back then, and it was brand new, in fact. And we have a brand new country, and we're establishing brand new laws. Mm-hmm. That must have been a very chaotic time to practice the law.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, they're probably just making up the law.
When I was young, my father had the phrase, "You've got champagne taste and beer money." And it seems that there's not even the beer money for the Hamiltons when they first moved down to Manhattan.
Well, yeah, they were kind of famously, I mean, he was famously kind of flashy and famously overspendy. And that was kind of one of the things in his personality that I really related to. And I really thought was made him so kind of lovable and human was that they lived on the money that he made, and they didn't really have a lot of money from the Schuylers, you know, even if he maybe had married her because, you know, he loved her, but, you know, she came from this very wealthy family. They actually lived on his salary, and he had to provide for her, you know, in reality, all their children. In my books, there are no children yet, but, you know, and send them to private school, get them outfitted, you know, as part of the gentry, you know, on the money that he made. And I just thought that that was so fascinating. So, of course, he was always in debt.
You said that you kind of identified with that personally. Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of your flashiness that you may have had early on.
Yeah, I was a scholarship kid to Columbia, and Hamilton was a student at King's College, which became Columbia. And you know, somebody who came to New York to kind of make my name. So I really, you know, kind of related to that, you know, coming to New York kind of with nothing but your dreams and your brain, trying to, you know, make a name for yourself and trying to keep up with other people who were a little bit more established, maybe.
Since you have a background in writing about fashion, did you especially enjoy the research into that stuff for this time period?
Oh, yeah. No, that's always really fun. What I found really fascinating was the women's social calendar. Like how relentless it was. You know, you got up, you went riding, and then you went visiting, and then you went visiting again, and you left your calling cards. You know, there was no social media. There was no telephones. Like if you wanted to keep a social life, you had to visit with people. I mean, it was all about etiquette, you know, and there were dinners and suppers and banquets and balls, and there were different rules for each. You know, did you get a full orchestra? Did you get two orchestras? Did you just get four people on the violin and the cello? You know, then that was a small dinner, and the suppers would be late until night. You know, they would party until, you know, 4 a.m. and then have to get up at 7 a.m. to go riding. I mean, it was kind of fascinating.
So tell me, you've please never just had a one orchestra party at your home.
Oh, yeah, no, there was always two.
There was also a very fascinating character in there who I'm assuming was a real life painter, Mr. Earl. Was he truly the handful that you portrayed him as?
You know, I had a little fun with Ralph Earl, and he was somebody who was locked up in debtor's prison and a very talented man that Alexander Hamilton felt badly for. And he had him do a portrait of Eliza, a very famous portrait of Eliza that we see now. And because Eliza was painted by this man, all of the society ladies wanted their portraits painted by him, and he was able to pay back his debts. And this was something that Alexander Hamilton did for him, again, out of a sense of justice and charity and trying to do too well by this very talented man in debt. So I don't know if he was quite that louche.
And when I mentioned beer money before, it was actually beer money that he was counting on because he was helping to defend a loyalist who ran a beer business.
Yes. So the case in the book is a loyalist who owns a brewery, and the brewery's land, the United States was trying to take it away from her, and Alexander Hamilton was arguing that she could keep it. It's not a real case. It's based on a few cases that were like that, but it's not real.
They move the family to Wall Street, which is a much different scene than it is nowadays there. It's amazing how much Manhattan has changed in those 200 years, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And it's funny because you don't think of Wall Street as a residential neighborhood. And I don't think there's really a lot of those kind of townhouses that remain, which is kind of sad. But Trinity Church is still there, and that's the church that they worshiped in, and they are buried there.
Had they moved further uptown? Did they get a farm that was further up toward
I think they went up to Harlem, in their later years.
And they had a very notable neighbor just across the street and down the way a little bit, didn't they?
Yeah, so that was kind of fascinating, finding out that Aaron Burr and his British wife just lived down the street from them in Wall Street. So I had to imagine that they knew each other quite well as neighbors.
If they would have gotten along a little bit better as neighbors, maybe the problem wouldn't happen later.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating thing. I was just talking about the duel with a friend of mine, and we were saying, why does it always come down to a duel? It's always, a little bit of machismo, a little bit of pride, and the gauntlet being thrown. Isn't there a way for people to kind of make peace without having to resort to violence? And I didn't really think of it that way because I find duels to be very romantic. But when she put it that way, I said, oh, yeah, they probably should have just worked it out.
Well, and they had lost their son a couple of years before.
Yes, to another duel. Yeah, so they're both victims of gun violence.
How much further into the future do you see taking the series into their romance?
I'm working on the third book now, and it's interesting. I jump a little ahead, but not too much, because I definitely want to get to all kind of the highlights of his accomplishments. But then also I feel like I can't really write their story without touching on, a big part of their marriage. The sadness of it was his infidelity to Maria Reynolds. So I kind of want to get there, too, trying to figure out how to go about that. And still remain in the YA genre.
Yeah, there was a couple of times where I saw the curtain come across at an appropriate time.
Oh, yeah.
You're always very busy. How many other books do you have in the pipeline right now?
I have a bunch. Next year is a big year. I have the third book in the Alex and Eliza series. I have a new Disney series called The Squad, which is a multicultural cast of superheroes. And then I have the fourth book in the Descendants series. And I also have a domestic suspense thriller called The Birthday Girl, which
is that going to be a standalone?
I think so, yeah. It's a book that I've been thinking about for about 10 years, and my husband keeps telling me, just write it. So I finally wrote the proposal, and I finally sold it, so I'm really excited. And then I also have a graphic novel from DC Comics in their YA line called Gotham High, about a young teenage Batman.
So going back to The Squad, can you give us some of the personalities that are involved in this superhero team?
Yeah, so it's a really fun project. It's four kids from four different backgrounds. One is from an African myth, Lekundu, the warrior. One is the Celtic god of thunder, Tyrannus. One is the Aztec goddess of beauty. And then the fourth is the kind of mischievous Chinese monkey of Chinese legend, Yeah, so it's been really fun. I'm kind of in the middle of that right now, trying to frantically finish polishing the first four chapters for a chapter sampler that's going to be available at BookCon.
We already got that optioned and ready to go for a big movie?
Yes, they optioned it from the beginning. That was like 3 years ago. This book has been kind of in the pipeline for a long time, but the Descendants books have been kind of taking priority. So I finally had time to really work on it this year.
So younger readers are always interested in how do you work? How do you get things done during the course of a day?
It's really hard to answer that question without lying. Because, you know, people will tell you, oh, I work 8 hours a day. Oh, I work 8 to 5 or whatever. And, you know, writers just, they just lie. It's really hard to explain how a book gets done. I think I can just say that for me, I don't really work in that kind of steady, you know, oh, I put in my whatever 10 pages every day and I'm done and it's great. You know, I'm not that kind of very organized person in that way. So what I do is I try to get in that mode and it's kind of very slow going for like the first, you know, if I'm going to write a book in 6 months, I would say like the first 4 months is very slow. And then the last 2 months, I basically write the entire book in a fever dream. And I think that's what, you know, is hard to explain. It's like, yeah, I don't leave the house for a week. And when I say I don't leave the house, I don't leave the house. You know, I'm in my pajamas. I've been working 16, 19 hours a day. I'm trying to get this book done. I don't really eat. I don't really see my family. So it's almost like you're sick. And I think that's probably the most honest thing I can say about how the work gets done.
Do you think you ever hit like a fugue state where the ideas are coming because you're so loopy or?
I mean, you know, because, you know, you're just trying to, like when I say you're trying to get the book done, you know everything already. You're just trying to get the words out as quickly as possible and then, you know, polish them again and again and again. And then you go over and you rewrite the book as many times as possible until you get it right. And then I turn it in.
So early on, was it difficult for you to let go of a book?
It's always difficult to let go of a book. I have editors who email me and say, just turn it in, please, just turn it in. Yeah, it's hard to let go because you just, you know, want to keep working on it.
Now, what were the books when you were young that made you want to be a writer?
Oh, I love Stephen King. He was a huge, huge influence. I loved him when I was 13 to about 18, my entire high school career was spent reading all of his books, going back and reading all the books from the 70s. And then, you know, whenever there was a new book from 1985 to 1989, I read it. I loved his letters to the readers. He always had this letter, Dear Constant Reader, and I felt like they were addressed to me, that I was a constant reader. And, you know, he would write books that were set in the same kind of universe where, you know, the Tommyknockers and the Dark Tower, you know, had like some kind of connection. It had the connection to the Dark Tower. I'm also a big Dark Tower fan. So I don't read a lot of his books anymore, but I was a big Dark Tower fan. So I kept reading those books even as I got older. And I always say that I started reading those books from 13, and I think the series ended when I was 36. So
I remember reading Cujo when I was quite young, and it scared me, but I read it when I was working at an AM radio station, and we played St. Louis Cardinals baseball games.
Oh.
And I would read while the game was going, and I had accustomed myself to hear the word out. And so anyway, I'd hear the word out, and my head would pop up. And go, okay, two outs. We're good.
Yeah.
And I read it over the course of 2 weeks doing that.
Oh, nice.
And Descendants 3 for the Disney Channel? When might we expect that?
I think that's coming out next year, and the fourth book is coming out next year also.
Well, Melissa, we want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing some time with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa De La Cruz is the author of Love and War, the second book in the Alex and Eliza series, and it's published by G.P. Putnam Sons Books for Young Readers. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.